The Tarncast, Tarncast, 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 it's the Tarncast, Tarncast, this is the Tarncast. Hey everybody, welcome to the Toddcast. This is very special guest, Todd Robert Anderson. No host this time around. Why is that, you might ask? Is Todd not trying hard enough? Is Todd phoning this in? Is Todd just doing these podcasts because of an odd self-imposed kind of, I don't know, I don't know. I don't know why I do this. I people always ask me, like, why so many Toddcast episodes when nobody really listens? And it's a hard question to answer. But the point is I couldn't get a host for this episode, and that's all there is to it. March has been a tough month with the flus and the colds and the stomach viruses, and it's been hard to when people are working for free, you see, they're not getting anything from this at all, really. They get nothing for it. It's just all they get to do is stroke my ego and make me feel better and make me feel like I'm doing something with my life, creatively speaking, when in fact I'm just letting the clocks, you know, run out, however slowly. But you never know when the alarm's going to go off and that's going to be it. I guess, I don't know. Is it important that we do stuff? Is it important that we accomplish things? Is it important to live a life that mattered to others? I don't know. I think that might all be bunk. So whatever. I couldn't find a host. Back off. Do you want to be my booking agent? Because, you know, put a message up on the website there and let me know. You know, talk to me. You can book stuff, people, for me. Heck, you can produce it if you want. Do all the post-production work and set up the mics and all that. Well, it's just one mic. But, you know, maybe you could start a Kickstarter campaign and get me a full, you know, studio and have the giant celebrity guests. I mean, I don't know. Why is it all on me to make this happen? I don't get it. I don't get it. Anyway, so again, obviously no host, but I felt, even though there is no host, there was no host and no actual show to speak of, I still thought it was important to sit down and record something, if for no other reason than to promote an evening of storytelling I'm doing on April 1st, 2015. Which is, at the time of this recording, it's next week, and this will post, and you'll have a few days to go, oh, hey, can I get to see Todd in an evening of storytelling called Public School at the Virgil in Los Angeles? Can I get it together to make that happen? But it is happening at April 1st, on April 1st, the night of April 1st, so go to the Virgil. And listen to lots of stories. There are a lot of great people. A number of people from the TV show You're the Worst will be telling stories. It's hosted by Stephen Falk, who is the creator of You're the Worst. So there's a lot of You're the Worst DNA in this evening of storytelling. I've done – Steve Falk is the producer, or one of the producers of this evening. So he hosts from time to time, and often when he hosts, he asks me to come tell a story. So I've done it a number of times. Let's see. Well, the last time I did it, I told a story about a friend of mine who took me to New York City and stoked the fires of my dreams the summer after we graduated high school. And then that summer, he was killed in a hiking accident. And the story was sort of about how cool I thought he was, and then how he really played an instrumental part in shaping my dreams, and you know, and encouraging me, and it was a horrible tragedy when he died, and then I went to his funeral, and it was like an open mic. Funeral is like endless acoustic guitars and songs and stuff, and that was my story about that. And then what was the story before that? Let's see. I told a story about, I can't remember what was before that. I did tell a story about the night my son was born, 2 months prematurely. And how it all suddenly in those moments, like after he was born and they wheeled him off to the NICU, how in that moment the doors closed and I wasn't allowed to come with him. I felt very helpless, and it was also the very first time that I felt what it meant to be a father. Like through the whole pregnancy, it wasn't registering. I still felt like a kid and it seemed surreal that I was having a baby, but on the night he was born in that incredibly dramatic circumstance when they took him away from me, you know, because he was born and then I had to leave. My wife said, go chase after, cause he was, you know, 2 months early. So they put him in this thing called an isolette, to keep all the germs and stuff, cause he's so fragile, out, and, you know, they keep him on breathing instruments and all that stuff. Super scary. See such a tiny little thing hooked up to all that medical equipment when you're the parent. But anyway, so we're like right after he was born, they're doing that and they're taking him away. And my wife said, chase him. And so I, you know, went with him as far as I could. And then when they got to the NICU, they told me to wait outside, cause it was going to be a little time before, you know, he could be exposed to anybody. So that was weird to be, you know, cause the cliche, the stereotype of when babies are born is the dad, you know, grabs the baby and holds the baby. And that's a beautiful moment. And the mom holds the baby, but we didn't get to because he was too fragile. Anyway, so that was that. I told that story. That one made people, made him cry. I sort of did the one that, about my friend dying. Those are the two actually that I told that were like made, people cry. My other ones were more, you know, funny. Not like stand up comedy funny, but there were, I don't want to say whimsical because they're real life stories and sometimes embarrassing, but they didn't choke you up, I guess. And they had more laughs in them. For example, I mean, the first one I told was about how, Steve Falk, and I, the aforementioned Steve Falk and I worked at a place in New York called the Learning Annex, which is an adult, like, night school. It's like, they call it continuing education, but the classes there, I mean, like, when I was there, I don't even know if there still is a Learning Annex, probably online or something. But they had catalogs all over New York City and they had classes like, how to drive your woman wild in bed and, how to control your man in 21 days or less. I remember that one because there was like, they actually, there was a men's group, which I didn't think was a thing, but there was a men's group. And they protested the class, saying it was offensive and insulting towards men, which I thought was hilarious. I always find it hilarious when especially white men complain about feeling, feeling like they've been attacked too much and they're the social group that's taking the most abuse. Cause that's just a ridiculous stance. Yeah. Hey, white guys, shut up. Yeah. Just shut up. So anyway, we worked there and there was this one time, you know, the company was not doing well. And so, you know, they hired like corporate consultants to get things going. And I remember Steve Falk and I very specifically, when we took the job, said we're not doing telemarketing. But what we did was we answered phones. We were registrars. We registered people who were calling to sign up for classes about how to drive your woman wild in bed and whatnot. And then like acting seminars with like Kevin Bacon and John Amos and all that. I saw the one with Kevin Bacon. He was okay. Anyway, not, you know, but it's like, you know, you hear a guy talk, for an hour and a half about his career and how he got, and it, how he as was successful as an actor, and it's not helpful at all. It's like, I still don't understand how, you know, to get to where you started. Never mind where you finished or where you're currently at. Anyway, I mean, I love Kevin Bacon. Don't get me wrong. It's just kind of a seminar with an actor talking about their career. Is if you want to garner anything outside of just mild entertainment from it, it's a waste of time. Anyway, so we would register people for classes. And when they brought in these corporate consultants, they started having lots of company meetings. And they said we wanted – first they wanted us to start upselling people when they called on the phone. Hey, if you're signing up for this class, you might also like this class, which we were not happy about. And then they wanted us to cold call people who had taken classes before and tell them, hey, there's this other class that you might be interested in, which I don't know how you define telemarketing, but that sounds like telemarketing to me. The woman who the consultant in the meeting said, now I want everybody to voice their questions and concerns. There will be no repercussions for, stating your mind honestly. And so Steve Falk, said, well, you know, when I took this job in the interview, I explicitly said I won't do any telemarketing. And I know that's true about a lot of people here. But he was the only one who spoke up. Nobody backed him up at all, because we all knew that despite what that woman had said, for saying such a thing, we would be canned. And Falk was immediately fired and sent away, which was messed up. But I really needed the eight bucks an hour or whatever it was, so I couldn't quit, you know, right away. But what I did do was spent the next few days lining up another job, had a start date for the other job. I didn't say anything to the learning annex until payday, and I took my paycheck, and I said, oh, by the way, I quit. And the manager, who was a woman, and she got very shaky and emotional when I fucked her like this. And she said, oh, well, thanks for the notice, like that. And I said, well, it was good enough for Steve, so I guess it's good enough for me. And that's like a nice comeuppance story. So yeah, I told that one. And then I can't remember what the theme, there's always a theme, you know. Steve will say, tell a story with this theme or that theme. And you have to concoct a story that fits with the theme. It's not always easy, but the point is I had to do one, and it was like a your most embarrassing moment, or like the worst thing you ever did. So I told the story of my 21st birthday party, which is wow. It's a very drunken story. I was very drunk and belligerent and got into fights. At one point, I was so offensive. My roommate and his friend locked me in to one of the bedrooms, literally broke off the doorknob so I couldn't. Oh, hey, how about that? My text came out. I got a text. Sorry, I was distracted. What was I talking about? I love getting texts, by the way, because it makes me feel, because I spend so much time, you know, alone by myself with no real hope. And I'll forget that there are people out there who know me and, you know, are willing to tolerate me on a social level. And that's cool. The texts remind me of that and make me feel, I don't know, wanted and liked and maybe even special. But anyway, so the my roommate and this guy, as I was saying, they broke the doorknob off, so there's no way I could get back into the party. But they had locked me in the room with the fire escape. So I have no recollection of any of this happening, by the way. It's just the fact that I didn't kill myself scaling down the fire escape on my 21st birthday party is that, I don't know. It's very, very lucky. I'm lucky to be alive. Anyway, so I climbed down the fire escape and then walked back up to the fifth floor where my apartment was, and I banged on my own door, and, my roommate answered, and, I yelled to the party, "I'm back, bitches!" And then continued to rage on like a jerk, getting into tussles and fights and insulting people and threatening. I threatened women, which is beyond the pale. Again, no recollection of, and I had to pay for it the next morning because the bathtub had become like the place where people barfed. I had to clean that, you know, gross that is. So, you know, that was all the punishment I really deserved in and of itself. But the point is, you know, it was really embarrassing. And, one of those really just deep life regrets that I just wish I could take it all back. Even though I don't remember any of it. But you know, whatever, 21, hormones, insanity. Yeah, hormones, man. Anyway, I told that story, and actually, a couple of people actually, after I told that story, were like, "Jeez, I had no idea that you could be so scary." So that was good. You know, hormones. I was thinking this the other day. It's like when you're a teenager, like all the sexually inappropriate things you might think or say or do, it's because you're hormonal. You know, you're a teenager, you're hormonal. What are you going to do? That's how teenagers are. And then when you do that stuff in your 20s, it's like you've become a man. You're a sexually realized man. And that's it. And then in your 30s, you're, and you're still doing that stuff. It's okay, because you know you're 30. You're an adult and you're a sexual being, and you may not have the stamina of your 20s anymore, but you're still, you know what you like and what to do, and so you know you're a mature, sexually mature being. And then once you hit like 40, when you're in your 40s and you still think those things, want to do those things, you're a creepy old man. You're creepy and old. And it's kind of funny. It's basically the same thing. You know, it's just when you get old, it becomes creepy. What other stories did I tell? Oh, the other one I told, I had to tell one story because usually they give you 7 minutes, but then they had certain events where they'd have people telling like really short stories. So I had to tell this one story in 3 minutes. It was a 3-minute story. And I told the story about the first moment I realized that I was going to marry my wife, which was in a parking lot. And we were in a grocery store. We had gone grocery shopping, and we were trying to get out of the parking lot so we could go home and empty out our groceries. And it was a Friday night even, so we were going to put the groceries away and chill and, you know, make out and stuff. Because, you know, it was our late 20s. I was a sexual, you know, sexually awakened young man, as opposed to now. I'm creepy. But we couldn't get out of the parking lot because there was this giant SUV blocking the way. Huge SUV. It was ridiculous. And then Danny Bonaducci, you know who that guy is from the Partridge Family? And he does like radio stuff now. Anyway, Danny Bonaducci was talking to someone in the car. Just talking to someone in the car. You know, leaning against the car, and they're talking through the driver's window. And we waited for a few minutes for them to wrap up, you know, the conversation. And after a couple minutes, you know, we started wondering how long this was going to take. And then 5 minutes later, we gave them a full 5 minutes to wrap shit up, and they were still talking. And so my wife-to-be, my girlfriend at the time, she gave a polite little honk of her horn just to let them know that we were back there, because maybe they were so engrossed in their conversation that they didn't realize someone was waiting on them. And Danny Bonaducci, like, stood away from the car and in all earnestness said, "Where do you have to go in such a hurry?" And that's when my girlfriend at the time, who would become my wife eventually, put her foot on the gas, pulled around the SUV, and drove straight for Danny Bonaducci, forcing him to run out of the way. And he was screaming and cursing at us. And in that moment, I looked at this woman and said, "This is the lady I'm going to marry." So I told that story in 3 minutes and dropped the mic. I didn't drop the mic. That would have been ridiculous. But the crowd loved it. They ate it up. And that was my biggest, like, you know, comedic reaction. They were just screaming with gales of laughter. So that was fun. I like to make people laugh. And it's always good when you get thunderous applause. Like a long time ago, here's a story. Oh, I haven't told. Man, this would make a good story for. I feel like this. Well, I don't know if it goes anywhere. You know, a lot of times showbiz stories like are awesome sounding if you're in showbiz, and then you tell people out of showbiz, and they're like, "Yeah, that just like why didn't you just say, hey, I did the show? I mean, that was you didn't need to say any more than I did the show." But I'm going to tell you this story anyway. Because I just thought of it. This is not a story I've told in storytelling. So premier storytelling event right now on this podcast. Think of it as a teaser for the story I'll be telling on April 1st, 2015 at the Virgil in Los Angeles as part of the public school storytelling evening that you should go to. But this – okay, so you may or may not know. I did a feature film, low-budge feature film. It's one of the great life experiences. It's called Fuzz Track City. It's out on DVD, and you can stream it. So go on Amazon, watch it in some manner. It's good times. So the guy who wrote and directed Fuzz Track City, his name is Steve Hicks. He's a great guy. Love Steve Hicks. He has hosted this show once early on. Anyway, so We're you know, together, involved in this thing called the 24-hour plays. This is a long time ago now. And the whole concept of the 24-hour plays, it was a fundraiser. It happened in a large theater, not a small one. Most of the theaters I worked in Los Angeles and have worked in are like 99-seat theaters, very small. This was a big place that could seat, I don't know, like 700 people. And the whole concept of the 24-hour play was that the play had to be conceived, written, cast, produced, and directed all in 24 hours. So what happened was you got to the theater, and people, the directors, the writer-directors, picked cast members out of hats, and then once you had your cast and the actors were all there, you'd meet your cast, you'd talk, get to know each other, and then the writer would go away and write something, and then overnight, and then the next morning the actors would get there and start putting it on its feet, and then at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock at that night, then the plays would go up, these one act plays. So as fate would have it, Steve Hicks was one of these directors, and he happened to draw my name, as well as three others, I think. or two others, three others. Yeah. I think there were four people. It was so long ago. I really don't remember. But anyway, so we met and we talked, he was the writer. That's right. He was the writer. And then there was a director. So those were separate jobs. You couldn't do both. So the writers went away and wrote, and then the directors would get it and the directors would put it on its feet. That's how it went. So the director who directed it, I hadn't met him before. This is sort of, you know, it's like a cool exercise in how arbitrary creative team, can, you know, turn something that maybe seems like nothing into something. I don't know. And the surprises that happen. It was a really cool process. Anyway, so we got together. There were the actors. Maybe there were only three of us. Shit, man. I can't remember if there were three. I think there were three of us. So there were three actors, and the writer, who I knew, and the director. And I didn't know the other two actors. I hadn't met them before. The actors went away. We went and got our beauty sleep, and the writer went home. Steve went home and started writing. And everybody got, I think the writers, in addition to like drawing the cast and the directors, also drew, like a topic or something. I can't remember. Or maybe it was just, you have these people right away, write whatever you're going to write. So, anyways, Hicks wrote that, and then we got there in the morning, and we read the short one-act play at a reading. And Hicks wasn't there. He had just given his job was over. He'd written. Now it was up to us. And he actually called me moments after we finished the first reading of it, and he said, "Look, man, I'm really sorry. I couldn't come up with anything. That's all I could come up with." Which was funny because we're all trying to look at it and analyze it and figure out how it's going to work. We were looking at it very non-judgmentally. But we weren't 100% sure what it was about. and he called and he apologized because he didn't know what it was about. But as it turned out, so, it, you know, we got it on its feet. We blocked it. We did a lot, you know, the director gave us a lot of notes and changed a lot of things, put these subtleties here and subtleties there. And then of course, the show started that night after a day of rehearsals, and it was sold out, you know, hundreds of people, you know, screaming and hollering, very supportive. And I can't remember where we came, like somewhere in the middle, and I just assumed people would be like, "What? Huh? This doesn't, I don't know." And we were all sort of playing like white trash people in a bar with a jukebox, and it involved, my character. I was sort of a misogynist, and I was drinking with my pregnant girlfriend and blah, zee, blah. The whole thing culminates in me, you know, sort of saying I have to maintain my individuality despite, you know, now being a father to be and all that stuff because of my pregnant girlfriend, and you know, in a fit of rebellion against responsibilities, I go to the jukebox and I put on Foreigner's Jukebox Hero and air guitar to it, and I remember the director gave me a specific note about how to do the air guitar, and I screwed it up because I got so overzealous and into it. Like, I started my guitar or air guitar strumming's a little too big, but it didn't matter because the crowd crowd had been laughing hysterically at this play the whole time, which like we were sort of as actors like all blown away. Like, this crowd is eating this up. They love it. And we didn't even know what the hell it was, really. I get up and I do this, you know, air guitar to Jukebox Hero, and the crowd just went ballistic. It was hysterical. They were screaming. They were applauding. It was so loud. I felt like a rock star in that moment. It was so cool. And we had no idea that was gonna. We walked in assuming nobody's going to understand this any more than we do. But something clicked. It clicked with the audience. It was just one of those neat moments. Yeah. So you don't know. You don't know how it's going to turn out. You gotta try. You gotta get through the whole thing. Anyway, yeah, that's my story. That was good, right? I told you a bunch of kind of stories and talked about storytelling for a half hour. What more do you want from a Toncast? You can't ask for more than that. I think it's great. I think I did a great job. I think you guys are great. So again, final plug, public school storytelling evening at the Virgil in Los Angeles, the night of April 1st, 2015. Please go. I love you. This has been the Toncast. I am Todd Robert Anderson. Toncast.